pretend not to understand the translator?
No, I said. Well, you gave injections, and after such injections, the persons died, did they not?
Yes, but as I've said in previous examinations, it was a matter of medical aid to patients in their dying agony.
And this medical aid resulted in death, did it not? Hardy asked.
I kept my gaze fixed on my hands in my lap.
No. I said, and this medical aid resulted in death, did it not? Hardy said.
My heart pounded as I studied my hands. As I said, these patients were in their dying agony.
Miss Oberhäuser, were you ever given any awards or medals?
I received the War Merit Cross, if I remember correctly.
And for what reason did you receive that medal?
I don't know. Hardy leaned on his podium.
Was it for your participation in the sulfonamide experiments?
Certainly not.
I have no further questions, Your Honor.
Though evidence of American experiments similar to those we were charged with was presented and visibly shook the American judges, in the end, the verdicts hinged on the issue of whether the subjects of the experiments had been volunteers. All I could do was wander the orchard and the prison exercise yard and wait. Fritz seemed devastated by the trial. While some of the doctors took it in stride and tried to research their way out of convictions, Fritz became withdrawn. We were not allowed to talk while in the courtroom. But he once spoke to me as he entered the elevator down to our cells.
They may as well hang me now, he said. I'm finished.
Fritz was the only doctor's trial defendant who was openly repentant, a fact that did not go unnoticed among the other doctors, the rest of whom stayed resolute to the end. The day of our sentencing, August 20th, 1947, I wore a black, long-sleeved wool coat dress with a white bow collar provided by the court. My heart hammered at my sternum as I listened to my colleagues' sentences announced one at a time in the great room. I waited my turn in the hallway behind the wooden courtroom door, a silent American guard at my side. I knew enough English by then to understand Dr. Gebhardt's fate.
Dr. Karl Gebhardt, Military Tribunal 1 has found and adjudged you guilty of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and membership in an organization declared criminal by the judgment of the International Military Tribunal as charged under the indictment heretofore filed against you. For your said crimes on which you have been and now stand convicted, Military Tribunal 1 sentences you, Karl Gebhardt, to death by hanging.
It was becoming increasingly difficult to breathe. When my turn came, the door slid open, I stepped into the courtroom and put on my translation headphones. The room took on a vivid color, saturated and intense as I searched the crowd for Mutti.
Hertha Oberhäuser, Military Tribunal 1 has found and adjudged you guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity, as charged under the indictment heretofore filed against you.
Once I heard the word schuldig in my translation headphones, I grabbed the railing. Guilty. Then came the sentence. I listened, numbed.
For your said crimes, on which you have been and now stand convicted, Military Tribunal 1 sentences you, Hertha Oberhäuser, to imprisonment for a term of 20 years, to be served at such prison or prisons, or other appropriate place of confinement, as shall be determined by competent authority.
I was careful to show no trace of reaction to the sentence. Fritz was sentenced to life in prison, and many of the others were doomed to join Gebhard at the gallows. I would be an old woman when released. In the 1 minute and 40 seconds it took to sentence me, they stripped me of a lifetime of work. On June 2, 1948, Dr. Gebhard was hanged on one of the three portable gallows in the prison gymnasium. I read in the paper that the nooses they used that day were not adjusted properly, and several of the defendants lingered, alive, for almost 10 minutes. The Americans couldn't even execute a death sentence properly. I was glad the Führer had taken his own life and had not been able to see that travesty. They soon bussed me to War Criminal Prison No. 1 in Landsberg, Bavaria, to begin my sentence. The thought of not practicing medicine for all those years was debilitating, and I started my letter-writing campaign. To the mayor of Stocksee went my first.
Chapter 35, Kasha, 1947. I screamed most of Wednesday, March 25th, 1947. At People's Hospital in Lublin, we nurses were happy to hear such screams, for it meant a healthy mother. A quiet birth was often a sad one. I was pleased that my baby's lung function was productive as well, for as a maternity nurse myself, I'd seen things go wrong in seconds. Breech births, blue babies. Our doctors were excellent, including my sister, but it was the maternity division nurses who made it hum. I was lucky it was a routine labor, since pain medication and other drugs were in short supply. Pietrik stood next to my bed, swaddled baby in his arms, and every nurse on the floor gathered around him. He wore a white hospital smock over his factory coveralls and held her in a most natural way, not stiff and awkward like so many new fathers. As kind as my visitors were, I just wanted to be alone with the baby and get to know our girl. "Give her back, Pietrik," I said, my vocal cords raw. Pietrik laid the baby back in my arms. I was soon sleepy, since it was warm for such a large ward, over 50 beds. My ward supervisor had reserved the best one for me, on the far wall away from the drafty windows next to the radiator. I breathed the baby's sweet sour scent and watched the fontanelle atop her head beat out a soft rhythm. She was as blonde as Mrs. Mikelski's baby. Jagoda would have been how old by now? 8? Should we name our baby Jagoda? That might be too sad. Maybe a name like Irenka. Hope. Pietrik lobbied for the name Halina, arguing my mother would have wanted that. But didn't he see it would be too painful to say my dead mother's name 10 times a day? The series of bells signaling visitor time rang, and the nurses scattered. Marta was first to arrive. She carried a plate of pochkis in one hand, napkins in the other.
"We come bearing gifts," she said. "Pochki for the mother?"
Papa brought up the rear bearing Marta's purse. "No, thank you," I said. I felt as round and fat as a pochki myself. When would Susanna be back to fend off Marta? She'd assisted at the delivery, but had been called away to set a fracture. Marta placed a sugar-frosted pochki on a napkin and set it next to me. "This is no time for a slenderizing course." I resisted sweets since I not only had baby fat to lose, but a cavity in my left canine tooth as well, a souvenir from Ravensbrück, and which stung when it met with sugar. My father kissed my hand, then my forehead, and the baby's too. "How are you, Kasha?" Pietrik lifted the baby from my arms, leaving me cold. He handed Papa the baby, Marta's purse still on Papa's arm. "We are thinking of naming her Halina," Pietrik said. "Well, I like the name Irenka," I said. It means hope.
Halina, of course, Papa said. How nice.
Were those tears in his eyes?
She favors you, Pietrik, Marta said. Will you christen her at home? Don't even think about the church.
She was right. The Polish Workers' Party no longer simply suggested a ban on religious ceremonies, including baptisms and weddings. It openly discouraged them and made life terribly difficult for those who disobeyed.
Marta and Papa were still not married, though many priests wed couples in secret. Marta scooped the baby from Papa's arms. This may be hard for you, Kasia, with your bad leg once you come home. I will take care of the baby.
As Marta cooed over the baby, a dark wave crashed over me. Why wasn't my mother here? Matka would walk the ward with a baby and show her off. She would tell me stories of myself as a child and make me laugh about it all. All at once, my face was wet with tears. I'd helped hundreds of mothers fight baby blues, but it was harder than it appeared, like being sucked down into a dark hole.
I need the baby back, please, I said.
Suddenly, I wanted them all gone, Pietrik too. If I couldn't have my mother, I wanted no one. Pietrik took the baby from Marta, who looked pained to release her, and placed her back in my arms.
Kasia needs to rest, he said.
Marta gathered her plate of pochkis.
We'll be back tomorrow with pierogies.
No, thank you, I said. They feed us well here. Once they left, and Pietrik went back to the factory, the baby and I drifted in and out of sleep. When the radiator started hissing steam, I woke with a start, thinking I was back on the train to Ravensbrück, the train's whistle screaming as we came to the platform. My heart raced, but I calmed once I looked at the baby. She shifted in my arms. Halina? So she would have my mother's name after all. As it was, I could barely look at my mother's picture without falling to pieces. More terrifying, could the child's name somehow cause her to follow Matka's terrible path? To live a wonderful life cut short? A shiver ran through me. Stranger things have happened. Once Pietrik and Papa started calling the baby Halina, I gave in and soon called her that myself. I needed to grow up, after all. I was a mother now, with responsibilities, no longer a child. Plus, everyone said it was a beautiful name, and it suited the baby. It honored my mother, and she would have been pleased. But somehow, I couldn't shake the notion I should have named her Hope.
Chapter 36 Caroline 1946 to 1947 Once I found the child and arranged for her parents to fetch her, I stayed in Paris doing my best to avoid Paul. He was a father now, and I wanted no part in disrupting his family. It was easy to avoid him since they remained at Rena's house in Rouen. You might think there is no better place to salve a wounded psyche than the City of Love. But that year, after the war ended, every park bench teemed with lovers kissing in public, some before breakfast, vivid reminders of my lost love. Even the news from home was grim, for Roger wrote that our elevator boy, Cuddy, had been killed in action in the Pacific. I became like a drug addict, the withdrawal from Paul hellish. No sleep, no appetite. Why could I not move on to a higher purpose? So I would remain unmarried, alone for the rest of my life. Worse things had happened to people. It didn't help that letters from Paul choked our letterbox. Mother lobbed each one into a basket in the living room with a labored stage sigh. More than once, I flipped through them, admiring Paul's handwriting, and held a few to the light. But why read them? It would only prolong the agony. I felt like Paris had cheated on me. We'd both been dealt a blow, but only she was recovering, starting to rebuild and clear the rubble. If the fashion industry was any indication, Paris was back, already holding elaborate fashion shows in the grand haute couture houses and magazine shoots against backdrops of ruined buildings, while I was still reduced to tears by a crippled pigeon or an old fruit man with three wormy apples arranged on a towel to sell. Months passed. I woke one November morning and vowed to immerse myself in work and not think of Paul even once more that day. There were no new letters in the basket, and fortunately there was still much to be done in Paris since rebuilding was in full swing. Turning oneself to the misfortunes of others is the best way to dispense with personal troubles. Hadn't Lord Byron himself said, "The busy have no time for tears"? Gasoline remained in short supply, so Parisians still rode their bicycles everywhere. Things like plates, matches, and shoe leather were still in short supply, not to mention decent food. Workers continued to cultivate beans and potatoes on the Esplanade des Invalides with horse and plow, but there were few eggs to be found, and ridiculously long lines formed at the bread and butcher shops at the hint of a rumor that a few scraps were available. Mother secured a supply of old K rations from a friend at the military post-exchange store to supplement our diets. Each cardboard rectangle held a miniature American breakfast: a tin of diced ham and eggs, Nescafe coffee, cellophaned crackers, a pack of Wrigley's gum, and a pack of Chesterfield cigarettes. It was a miracle our boys had stayed alive to fight in spite of those breakfasts, but any food was precious then. Mother volunteered for the ADIR, the National Association of Deportees and Internees of the Resistance, a new organization that helped women deportees returning from Nazi concentration camps get back on their feet. These lucky women often had lost everything, their husbands and children, their homes. To make matters worse, the French government focused on the men who returned, military men especially, but any males who'd survived the war. Somehow the returning women were an afterthought. I volunteered here and there as well. Since so many children in Paris lacked coats, Mother and I appealed to Le Bon Marché department store to allow us to set up a donation station just outside the store's doors, and they agreed. They carted out coat racks and folding tables to the cordoned-off area, and Mother and I hung donated children's coats by size. The price of admission into our little shop was one child's coat. A parent could choose from any of our coats and jackets in a larger size, and the donated garment was cleaned and redistributed. Le Bon Marché even advertised our event, running a grim little photograph of Mother and me at the bottom of their newspaper ad. We chose a perfect sunny November day to set up, when all of Paris was out to see what fashions the stores held for the coming season. Dior had debuted his revolutionary new look, with its nipped waists and full skirts, that spring, and Paris was abuzz about what he'd unveil next. It was hard not to feel optimistic that day, with the scent of roasting chestnuts in the air and the one-man band in the adjacent park playing a lively version of Le Chalon qui passe. Soon people queued up and crowded in. Mother had left me in charge, for she'd already achieved field marshal status in the post-World War II French charitable world and had gone to oversee a soup kitchen on the other side of town. I was thrilled, for I desperately needed a new mission of my own. Besides, I'd become good at picking the perfect coat for a child. The key was in the coloring. This was Paris, after all. A yellow coat on a sallow child was almost worse than no coat at all. The coat exchange was packed by mid-morning, when I realized I'd never opened my ration box. Before I could reach for it, an elderly woman approached me. "Excuse me, mademoiselle. Would you assist me, please?" She was gaunt but had the bearing of a countess, well-dressed in her wool skirt and cardigan and clean white gloves. She wore a faded pink Hermès Saumur scarf fastened with a jeweled partridge brooch, the belly of which was a South Sea pearl. Even in dire circumstances, or perhaps because of them, the women of Paris continued to pull themselves together with unexpected touches, still subscribing to the fashion truism that too much simplicity is timid. In one hand, the woman held a white paper package, a Malacca walking stick hooked over her wrist. In the other, she held the leash of an ebony-colored standard poodle. It was a magnificent animal, and, like its owner, thin but beautifully groomed. "I have brought a coat," she said. I took the package, broke the cellophane tape, and lifted out the coat, releasing a musky scent of rose and lavender. I'd seen many lovely garments that day, some with hand-embroidered flower plackets and enameled buttons or glorious rabbit fur linings. But this coat was in a category all its own. Cashmere? It was the color of a robin's egg and surprisingly heavy, but soft and lined with quilted white satin. "Thank you for your donation, madame. Please choose another. We have many good coats. Perhaps maybe none as fine as this one. It is lined with goose down. It was made for my granddaughter. Never worn." "Help yourself to the rack. What size is your granddaughter now?" The woman smoothed her hand down the dog's neck. Upon closer inspection, I saw she'd misbuttoned her cardigan, giving her sweater a cockeyed skew. Her jeweled brooch was missing a diamond. Sold or lost? "Oh, she's gone. Taken with her mother and brother years ago now. My daughter and one of our maids had been printing leaflets in our pantry." The underground. "I'm so sorry." My sight blurred. How could I comfort others if I couldn't control my own emotions?
"I kept it, thinking she might come home. But then they took me. Can you imagine? What would they want with an old woman? My housekeeper kept my dog in Saint-Étienne while I was, well, away. Is my family now?"
She shook her head, unable to continue, then straightened.
"Perhaps someone can use the coat."
I returned the coat to the wrapping. "Thank you, madame. I will make sure it finds a good home. There is hot coffee inside." She laid her gloved hand on mine for a long moment, the cotton warm and smooth.
"Thank you, dear."
I pulled a card from my pocket. "This is the ADIR, a charity my mother supports. They help women coming back from, well, from the camps, run by women who were deportees themselves out of one of their apartments, near Le Jardin de Luxembourg."
"Thank you, mademoiselle."
She took the card and turned. "Wait, madame." I pulled my K-ration box from beneath the table. "I have an extra. Would you like it?" She eyed the box.
"Oh, no, dear. Give it to someone more.
Please take it."
"Well, I do have a neighbor.
I smiled. A neighbor. Good, then. I'm glad it will be well used. The woman tucked the box under her arm and made her way out of our little coat exchange, jostled and pushed by the crowd. There were many such stories that afternoon, and by day's end I was ready to rest. But the crowds only grew larger. To make things worse, the temperature dropped, making me all too aware of my own coatlessness. Mother had mistakenly added our own coats to her donation piles and carted them off, and as a result, I had no outerwear of my own. The wind picked up, blowing coats off their slippery wooden hangers. I stooped to retrieve a jacket and stopped short as I stood. I couldn't miss Paul in the crowd, taller than most, working his way toward me. My first instinct was to dive into the crowd myself and avoid seeing him. But who would man the booth? He'd in all probability moved on by now, I thought, adjusted to his new life, forgotten me. As he came closer, it was hard not to notice he looked good in his aubergine velvet jacket. He had been eating, it seemed, still thin, but finally filling out. Paul made his way to me, both of us jostled about by the crowd. He held out a small tweed coat the color of ripe wheat with a wilted tricolor ribbon pinned to the breast. I took it, careful not to touch him. One touch and I'd be back into it all, and the pain would return. It might even be worse. "Remember me?" he asked. It had been almost 2 years since we'd last seen each other at his kitchen table. "Thank you for your donation, monsieur. Please choose another." It was Pascaline's coat, of course, thin and light, a wool-cotton blend. The sleeves had been let down twice, leaving lines dark as graphite around each cuff, and two lovely little patches had been sewn into the warp of the tweed with tiny, regular stitches. "Rena. I'm sorry you have to talk to me, Caroline. You obviously don't want that."
"We have many good coats.
Would you please look at me?"
He passed the fingers of his free hand across his lips. Paul, nervous? That was a first. The velvet at the elbow of his jacket was worn. Had Rena not cared enough to mend his, too? Paul reached for my arm.
"It's been terrible without you, see."
I stepped away. Was he acting? He was good at that, after all.
"You are free to choose any coat." Why could I not stop babbling about coats?
Paul stepped closer.
"I'm in a bad way, Caroline."
If he was acting, he was doing a remarkable job. He clearly hadn't slept any time recently. Overcome, I turned and held a coat rack to keep it from toppling over in the breeze. Paul grabbed my wrist and turned me toward him.
"Did you even read my letters?"
I shook off his hand. "I've been busy. You should see the apartment. Mother's been boiling cottons on the stove."
"If you would just read them, you'd know..."
"You should see her on a stool stirring the pot with a canoe paddle." I turned away and straightened the coats. He followed.
"So this is it. We'll never be together again."
He stood taller for a moment. Misery looked good on Paul. Unshaven, messy, lovely misery. I buttoned a tiny pink coat.
Paul stepped back. "I had to see you when I read you'd be here. Hitchhiked all the way from Rouen."
"You'd better start back soon. It looks like rain."
"Is this someone else? I've heard you were with a man."
"What?"
"Holding hands at Café Georges. You're well known, Caroline. Word gets around. You at least owe me an explanation."
I'd lunched with one of Mother's admirers, a bearded count from Amiens, 20 years my senior, Disconsolate that Mother had little time for him, he'd spent half the lunch with my hand in his, pleading for me to intervene, keeping me from my vichyssoise.
How can you be so unfeeling, Caroline?
Unfeeling?
I still can't even work. And you go about your do-gooding here as if I'm no one to you.
Do-gooding? I felt my Irish temper rise up my back in warm prickles despite the cold. I turned to face him.
How unfeeling were you when you decided to have a child? I said.
You knew I was married.
Incompatible, Paul. You said children complicate things, remember? No place for that in an actor's life.
Things happen. Adults deal with them. Unless they're rich and spoiled.
Spoiled? Really? Is it spoiled to give up my own happiness for that of a child I don't even know? Do you have any idea what it's like waking up every morning, knowing you and your family are together, and I'm alone? Don't talk to me about unfeeling.
It wasn't until he opened his jacket and wrapped me in velvet that I realized I was shaking.
Be sensible, Caroline. When will either of us find what we have again?
True, I said into the cotton of his shirt. You may be the only man left in Paris.
He laughed and pulled me closer.
I miss you, see?
His heavenly scent surrounded us. Cocooned in that jacket, his fingers interlocked at the small of my back. I'd missed that musky essence of pine and leather. He brushed his lips against my cheek.
Come and get something to eat, he said. Even over the terrible band, I can hear your stomach growling. A friend of mine has a place in a Latin quarter you'll love. He's made an apple tart with real creme fraiche.
How wonderful it would be to slide into a bistro booth with Paul, the leather seat allowing us to sit hip to hip, as so many lovers before us had done. The offerings would be meager, but there would at least be warm bread and wine. We'd talk about everything. Which creme fraiche is best? From southeast or southwest France? Which new play should he do? How much he loved me. But then what? He'd go home to his family and leave me worse than before.
I'll come to New York,
Paul said, his lips soft against my ear.
It will be like before.
I felt his chest against me, only the silk of my dress and the cotton of his t-shirt between us.
You can't just leave here, Paul. Even if he didn't have a family, it could never be like before.
The world was so different now. Paul stood back, held me at arm's length, and smiled his most dangerous smile.
I need to get back to New York. Broadway's rebounding, you know.
I pulled away and shivered as the wind ballooned the skirt of my dress. Was he using me to escape his new responsibilities? Did he want me, or just relief from family life?
Come on, see. We could do something together. I'd consider Shakespeare. Let's talk about it at dinner.
I felt a drop of cold rain on my hand. I would have to move the coats under the overhang of the store.
You need to get back to your family, Paul.
Paul stepped back.
You're infuriating.
You're a father.
But I love you.
Love your daughter.
If you don't, I'll have given you up for nothing, so act if you have to. And soon, you'll find you mean it. I touched his sleeve.
It's not that hard. Just be there. When she wakes in the night afraid. If she stumbles at school.
Rena doesn't want me there.
Your daughter does. She wants you to teach her to sail a boat. Show her off in the park. You don't know how powerful your love is, Paul. Without it, she'll fall for the first boy who says he loves her, and he'll shatter her for good.
Why throw away everything we have? It's ridiculous, your pilgrim ethics.
Puritan, I said.
I don't think I can do it.
You can. Funny thing about grief. It gets easier with practice. I held out a white package. This coat's perfect, I said. A bit large, but she'll grow into it.
I love you, see.
And I'm stubborn too, you know.
Love her, Paul. If not for you, then do it for me.
You're going to wake up one morning and know you've made a terrible mistake.
I suppressed a smile.
Like every morning.
Paul stared at me for a long moment, then slipped off his jacket and draped it across my shoulders. He wore only an old white T-shirt underneath, threadbare in parts. It was a pre-war shirt, no doubt, for it hung somewhat loosely. But the sight of Paul in it, even thin as he was, caused more than one woman in the booth to stare.
"This always looked better on you," he said.
The satin lining of his jacket felt good against my skin, still warm from him. Paul kissed me on both cheeks and took the white package. I smoothed the flap of one velvet pocket in my fingers, soft as a cat's ear. I looked up just in time to watch Paul's beautiful back as he retreated through the crowd. And then I turned and pushed the racks out of the rain. In the months that followed, Paul sent a few more letters, and I tried to distract myself with volunteering. At least I had Mother, though she would not be with me forever. Our life became reduced to a routine well known to those in homes for the aged. Tea with Mother's friends, the conversation revolving around inflamed sacroiliacs, the odd errand at the embassy for Roger, and church choral concerts. They were pale days, one indistinguishable from the next. So a visit from a friend of Mother's one morning threw me for a loop. Mother had told me a friend of hers named Anice Postel-Vinet, who'd been arrested while working for the French underground during the war and held at Ravensbrück concentration camp, was stopping by our apartment. Anice and friends had founded the ADIR. Though Mother was uncharacteristically evasive when I asked for details, I agreed to this favor, expecting Anice to appear at our apartment asking for gently used clothing or canned goods. That day, Mother, midway through her unfortunate poncho phase, was sporting a red-checked, caftan-esque affair she'd resurrected from somewhere when Anice arrived. Parisians stared when Mother wore that poncho, as if picturing it where it belonged, flung over a café table under a plate of good cheese. The doorbell buzzed, and Mother showed Anice in. Two men followed behind, carrying a canvas stretcher on which a woman lay wrapped in a white cotton blanket. "Dear God," I said. Anice, a handsome, no-nonsense woman, planted herself on our living room au buisson and ran the fingers of one hand through her cropped hair.
"Good morning, Madame Faraday. Where should the men take her?"
I took a step back.
"She's staying? Here? We knew nothing of this."
Mother went to the stretcher.
"Anice asked if we could help this Polish friend of hers," she said to me. "She's unconscious, Anice?"
Anice laid her hand on the woman's blanketed leg.
"Heavily sedated? Just flew her from Warsaw."
"She needs a hospital, Madame Vinet," I said.
"Her name is Janina Grabowski. I knew her at Ravensbrück concentration camp. Operated on by Nazi doctors."
Anice felt the woman's forehead.
"We need to handle this privately. She was brought out of Poland, well, without the knowledge of the authorities."
We were to take in a sick Polish fugitive? Could she get no help in Warsaw?
Most of Warsaw has been reduced to rubble, Miss Faraday. Their healthcare system is a mess. Antibiotics in short supply.
Anise threw back the blanket to show us the woman's leg. Under the gauze, an angry infection raged.
Take her to my room right away, Mother said. I'll cut some fresh bandages.
At last, Mother could relive the nursing days of the Woolseys on the Civil War battlefield.
We'll call our personal doctor for her.
I held one hand to the stretcher. Wait. I listened to the trial on the BBC. The Germans are supposed to be providing reparations.
None, Miss Faraday. Germany decided they do not recognize communist Poland as a country. They consider it part of Russia.
That's ridiculous.
Janina is a charming person who once gave me the medicine she could have used to save herself, allowing me to stand here now. She has suffered more this morning than you will in your lifetime, and could quite possibly be dying as we speak.
I waved the man along. We are happy to have her, I said.
Good. Thank you, mademoiselle.
I walked to the window. Put her in my bed. First door on the left. The men carried the stretcher down the hall to my bedroom, and Mother followed. As they passed, I saw that blood from Janina's leg had seeped through the blanket. What had we gotten ourselves into?
We are at your service, Madame Vinet, I said.
Anise walked to the door.
Your mother told me you'd help.
She turned and almost smiled.
That's good, because there are 62 more where she came from.
Part 3. Chapter 37. Kasia. 1957. I picked Halina up from daycare one night after my last nursing shift. The facility was housed in one of many government-controlled childcare centers. In Lublin at the time, any child with two working parents was assigned to a childcare facility where school-aged children spend their days learning basic math, reading, and Communist Party rhetoric. I walked toward ours, which was situated in a drab former housing complex requisitioned by the party. A beige, humorless place that smelled of cooked potatoes and cabbage, a smell I still could not tolerate 12 years after Ravensbrück. At least the government paid for it. As I waited for the class to be released, I leaned against the wall to take the pressure off my bad leg and considered my new bracelet, the result of a plan Father Scala and I had worked out. Father, Papa's dear friend, was our former parish priest, now retired. At Susanna's urging, I approached him for advice about my being overwhelmed as a mother. With trying to juggle work, caring for a young daughter, and being a wife, I was often worn to a frazzle and lost my temper more and more. Father Scala suggested that in addition to prayer, I might also wear a rubber band on my wrist and snap it every time I felt my temper getting the better of me. I wore the doll bed band on my wrist and did a good deal of band snapping each day. By week's end, my wrist was raw from snaps. No running, Comrade Yinda, Halina's unit leader, called out as the children made their way to their parents. It was easy to spot my daughter in the crowd. She had Matka's golden hair and was a hand taller than most of the other children. At 10 years old, Halina was a year behind the children her age, for she had been held back for not knowing her multiplication tables. How lovely it was to see her, my reward, the prize God had given me for all I'd been through. The children walked up to meet their parents and exchanged the accepted greeting. Halina shook my hand and gave me a perfunctory kiss on the cheek. She had a lovely scent all her own,
of soap and fresh air, even after being in that dreary place.
"Good evening, Matka," Alina said.
Comrade Yinda noted with a smile that all children were accounted for and turned to assemble the next group.
"A real kiss for your mommy, Halina," I said.
She reached her small hand to mine. "You know it's not allowed." We headed for the door. What a serious little thing she'd become.
"So how is the most wonderful daughter today?"
"Not more wonderful than any other," Halina said.
"Was rest time better today?"
"At daycare, the children were taught to eat and rest and even use the toilet on cue."
"I just pretended to rest," Alina said.
By the 1950s, the Polish United Workers' Party, or PZPR, Moscow's thinly disguised Polish proxy, was in complete control. Though Stalin was dead by then, his policies lived on. He had promised the Allies at Yalta that he would provide free elections in Eastern European countries and allow them to operate as democracies, but instead installed a Communist Party government in each country, Poland being no exception. We ended up with rigged elections, no independent political parties, and no criticism of the party allowed. All policy was based on the collective needs of the people. I was reassigned to be a trauma nurse at the new state hospital and Pietrek to factory work just outside Lublin, where he was bused daily. "I'll talk to your teacher," I said. "She must make sure you are getting a good sleep." With morning drop-off at 5 a.m. and pick-up at 7 p.m., a child needed a rest during the day.
"No, Matka, I'm not a baby. Besides, Comrade Yinda would just put me at the end of the lunch line again if you complain. Plus, it's fine. It let me think about what I would paint this weekend."
My leg burned as I hurried her past the bread line. "We have no paints, Halina."
"We have your mother's brushes."
"How was math class?"
"Comrade Yinda made flashcards. I may be in baby math until I am as old as you. I hate times tables."
"I use math every day as a nurse."
"Marta said she would buy me paints for my name day."
"When is the placement examination?" I asked.
"I don't know,"
Halina said. She picked up a stick from the road and dragged it, drawing lines in the dirt along the side of the road.
"Did Comrade Yinda let you be on the blue team?"
"Yes," Halina said. "Without any trouble?"
"Yes. Once I told her there was no proof Jesus rose from the dead, she let me do anything I wanted."
I stopped short, sending a ripple of pain up my calf. "Who told you that?" I asked.
"I don't know," she said with a shrug.
I tucked that shocking bit away to discuss with Comrade Yinda. Religion was supposed to be off-limits at school. It was bad enough we had to sneak around to go to Mass. Every trip to church meant a black mark on one's record, and there were people paid by the authorities to note such things. The child care facility was a 20-minute walk from our apartment. My leg ached from standing most of the day caring for patients, but I was luckier than most, since I lived within walking distance of child care. Many of the other nurses were assigned to housing outside the city and only visited their children on weekends. We were also lucky that Papa, somehow still working in his postal center job, managed to keep us all in our apartment. Pietrek, Halina, and I lived in my old bedroom. Susanna slept in her old closet room, which only fit her bed, and though I tried not to think about it, Papa and Marta slept in the room he and Matka once shared. The smell of buttery pastry met us at the door. Marta had been baking Halina's favorite kowalski again. Halina ran to Marta.
"Babcia!"
"My little chastko," Marta said as she turned from the stove and gathered Halina in her arms.
"Did you buy me paints?" Halina asked.
"Halina," I said, "that's not polite."
"It's fine," Marta said,
sitting Halina at the table with a plate of apricot kowalski. "She is just a girl."
"She knows better," I said.
I walked down the short hallway to my room, feeling as if a hot poker were stabbing my calf with every step. My old bed was pushed to one side, and a small bed for Halina stood along the other wall, the bed I shared with her most nights. When had Pietrik and I started sleeping separately? Pietrik sat reading a book, still in his gray coveralls from the factory. He'd been assigned to the Lubkal ladies' garment factory, in the new suburb of Helenov, on the edge of the city. It had its own training school and on-site residences for which we put our name on the waiting list. It may sound strange, but I love those coveralls. They fit him well in all the right places. His broad shoulders and long legs. "What are you reading?" I asked. My leg ached, and I wanted more than anything to stretch out on the bed. Pietrik did not answer. His book wore a brown paper cover, but it was Dr. Zhivago, one of many books on the banned list. His friend Alexander had been sent away for reading Thoreau's essay, Civil Disobedience, so Pietrik was smart about where he read. I tossed my bag onto the bed. How was work? They took Szymbanski today, right from his bench. Didn't make quota. He gave them a bottle of vodka, but they still took him. We need to make the best of it. We need a third world war. I stepped out of my uniform so that I was only wearing my slip. The one he'd once said made me look like Myrna Loy. Halina needs to study for the math exam. Can you help? Pietrik kept his gaze on his book. Does it matter how she places? She will end up on the assembly line next to me. If she can get on the medical track, let her be. Pietrik dog-eared the page. And stop badgering her teacher. The room closed in on me. I snapped my rubber band. It smarted the inside of my wrist, but it did little to stop my mounting temper. I don't badger anyone, I said. They'll have you on some list before you know it. Your father won't be able to get you off it, no matter how cozy he is with the Kremlin. I reached for Pietrik's arm. You understand? I need some say in my child's life. Let's find time to talk about it, alone. Keep your voice down, Kasia. Pietrik tossed his book on the bed and walked to the door. Marta knows enough of our business. He left and shut the door behind him. He enjoyed his little rebellions. The rubber band wasn't helping me, so I filled my lungs with air to combat the anger. Once I heard Susanna return from work, I hurried to change. I came out from my bedroom to see her kiss the top of Halina's head and steal some kowachki from her plate. Did you eat today? I asked Susanna. Some greet their sisters with hello, she said with a crooked smile. She had a dark smudge beneath each eye. How was the hospital? Marta asked. Good, said Susanna. We may be getting 10 new beds. That's a good thing, I asked. More work for the same pay, Pietrik said. I noticed the tin box of paints near Halina's plate, a fancy British brand. Where did the paints come from? I asked, trying to keep my voice steady. Certainly not from a store. There were no more private shopkeepers at that point, and government shops did not sell foreign brands. These were black market paints. A friend got them for me, Marta said. An early name day gift. I told her no paints, I said. Let it go, Pietrik said under his breath. I closed my eyes and took a lung full of air. Give me the paints, Halina. Kasia, said Susanna, her hand on my shoulder. I shrugged it off. That was when I noticed the brush, the sable hair tip of it under Halina's plate. Matka's Kolinsky watercolor brush, the gleam of its nickel throat in the shadow of the plate. Where did you get that? I said, short of breath. Marta gave it to me, Halina said. Marta stepped toward me. She has such a talent. Give me the brush, Halina, I said, my arm outstretched, palm up. Halina curled her hand around the paints and brush and put them in her lap. "Give them to me," I said, stepping closer. "Let it go," said Pietrik. The blood rushed in my ears, heart thumping against my chest. Halina stood and ran to Marta, paints and paintbrush in hand. "Give them to me," I said, following. "It is my fault," Marta said, one arm around my daughter. I grabbed for the paintbrush. "No," Halina said, pulling back. "I am your mother. You must listen to me, not to Comrade Yinda, not to Marta, to me." Halina stood her ground, clutching the paints and brush to her chest. "No," Halina said. "She is..." Marta began. "Stay out of this. Would you once allow me to speak to my own child?" I stretched out my arm. "Give me the paints, Halina." "Never," Halina said in a matter-of-fact way, looking me straight in the eye. It couldn't have been my hand that placed the slap there, for it happened before I could even think about it. Yet I slapped her hard across the face. As soon as my hand left her face, I wished I could take it back, but nothing could fix that. "Kasha," Pietrik said, his tone not so much accusatory as, worse, disappointed. Halina did not even cry, just dropped the paintbrush and paints on the floor next to her. I picked up the black lacquered brush and, one hand on either end, cracked it over the back of a kitchen chair, which resulted in a satisfying snap, leaving the two shattered ends like cat's whiskers. I retreated to my bedroom, vibrating with shame, and stood in the tiny room looking at the bed Halina and I shared. Her stuffed bear sat upright against the pillow. I lay on the bed and held the bear to my own chest. It smelled of Halina, of sweetness and honesty. What kind of a mother had I become? Before long, the bedroom door opened, and Marta stepped in. I sat up with a groan. Marta shut the door. "I may be the last person you want to see, but no one else would come in. Please, Marta, this isn't... I've watched you for 12 years now, Kasha. I understand a lot more than you may think. I'm not feeling well, my leg... I understand that your mother favored you, that you lost her, and that is a terrible thing. But it's time to move on. Time for some honesty." "Honestly, you get in my way. I'm the only one who disciplines my daughter. You just cook and give her things." "Your daughter needs love." "Don't lecture me. Of course I love her." "You have to rise above all this and show her." Marta sat beside me on the bed. "And you can't force Halina to be something she's not. Nothing good comes of art." "What happened to your mother was tragic, but let's move on. I'd like to rest now." "And your husband? He needs help, Kasha. It's your life, but your mother would want Halina to be cherished. Your papa and I are going to stay with friends tonight. Pietrik and Halina will take our room, so you have some time to think. You have a choice. To wallow in the unfairness of it all or rise above it. Fix it. Let other people in." "Easy for you to say. You don't feel the heavy load of it all. You're not even a mother." Marta stepped to the door. "And neither are you right now, dear girl." She left. And for the first night in so long, I had the room to myself. A quiet space to think and work things out. I looked at my rubber band limp on my wrist. From now on, I would use my own resourcefulness and intuition. By the time I fell asleep, I had a plan. I would make things better. I would look for help, let other people in. Make sure I spent more time with Halina. Pietrik and I would find time to be alone together. I'd survived Ravensbrück. How could ordinary life be harder than that?